Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past 2021. The Historical Novel Society Australasia acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live. We pay respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. In this season of Imagining the Past, we'll take a sneak peek at writers and issues showcased at this year's Historical Novel Society Australasia's virtual conference, which will be held over two successive weekends on the 16th and 17th of October and the 22nd to 24th of October 2021. The online conference offers boot camps and craft workshops, with the main conference program featuring 2 days of interviews, panels and chat salons for both writers and readers of historical fiction. For more information, please visit hnsa.org.au. In our upcoming podcast, I'll be chatting with some of the conference guests about their work and their inspirations. So pop on the kettle, pop on your headphones, and let's start imagining the past. Pip Williams' first publication was a poem in Dolly magazine when she was 15. I think I remember it. In 2017, she published One Italian Summer, a memoir of her family's travels in search of the good life. In 2020, Pip published The Dictionary of Lost Words, which was the best-selling debut novel in 2020 and won several awards, including the Mudd Prize for Debut Fiction, the Indie Book of the Year, the Australian Book Industry Awards General Fiction Book of the Year, and the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards People's Choice Award. I'm out of breath. She was also longlisted for the ARA Historical Fiction Prize. And a warning before we start, this podcast contains discussions of dictionaries and strong language. I started by welcoming Pip to Imagining the Past.
Thank you, Greg. It's lovely to be here.
Just to start, I'd like to know what your first inkling was that you had to become a writer.
Oh, what a great question. You know, nobody has asked me this question in terms of when was that first time that I thought about being a writer, because actually it was when I was a child, a really small child. I always wrote, despite the fact I have, I don't know if you know this, Greg, but I'm dyslexic, and so my relationship with words and language has always been slightly problematic. People understand dyslexia in general as difficulty spelling and maybe difficulty reading. I can read, but it probably took me longer to learn than most, but I can't read very fast. So, in fact, I can't read any faster than I can read aloud. So that's how fast I read silently, which means it takes me ages to finish a book, but I love it. And I can't spell, that's true. But there's so many other aspects of dyslexia that can create, I suppose, challenges sometimes with language. And it's the ability to recall words and sometimes use the correct word in speech. The wrong word will often come out of my mouth. I can't imagine the written word, which is a really odd thing. And I can't remember, you know, the written word. I can't recognize things. So I used to get lost around my own home because I didn't recognize the street names, if that makes sense. I still couldn't remember the streets that were near my street, even though I'd lived there for 10 years. And it's this, you know, and also people with dyslexia often have terrible sense of direction and get travel sick as well. So there must be some sort of visual component. There's all sorts of things. But anyway, we're not talking about dyslexia. We're talking about when I got that first inkling I wanted to write. And I guess the reason I raise it is that I wanted to write as soon as I knew what writing was, even though I found it difficult. And it's almost just an irony, really, that the way I wanted to express myself wasn't through dance or music or anything like that. It was through words. And luckily, I was probably about 8 years old when I started writing poetry. And of course, it was 8-year-old poetry, so I'm not going to recite any of it for you. It was all about horses and you know, my mum and dad and my sister and, you know, pretty skies and things like that. But I wrote poetry right through until adulthood, actually, as bad as it was. And I wrote it because I was just writing it for myself. So there's almost two questions there. There was, when did you first start to write, you know, in order to express yourself? And when did you first think that this is something you could share? Because I never thought of sharing my writing when I was a child or even a teenager until I was about 15. And when I was 15, I wrote a poem called 15, and all about the angst of being 15. And I sent it into Dolly magazine and they published it. And that was the first time. Yeah. And that was the first thing I'd ever had published. It was the first thing I'd ever tried to have published. And it was the first time I'd thought about sharing something that I'd written. And when I say that, I'm not just saying sharing something I'd written and produced. I'm also saying it was the first time I'd thought to share my inner self, because that's what poetry is often about, with strangers, because I thought that it might connect, that I thought my experience might connect to their experience. And it did. And that's why Dolly magazine published it, because it was a magazine for 15-year-old girls. And from then on, writing, my relationship to writing changed, actually. From then on, it became more performative. And I think it became something that I then worried about. And unfortunately, I didn't do it as much. I still wrote poetry for myself. I certainly didn't try to publish anything else. And then, even though writing was so important to me and the way I expressed myself most freely, I didn't pursue writing as a career or even a hobby, actually. I just kept it to, you know, journaling and angsty poetry for a very long time.
Were you supported with your writing at school, or were you, because of your spelling and problems with language, were you kind of diverted by teachers into science? Or
if only they could divert me into science. I would have had to get more than 45% in physics for someone, for a teacher to think that that would be a good diversion. I was supported in that I wasn't discouraged, if that makes sense. So nobody ever said to me, even though it was very clear in terms of, you know, for my parents and for my teachers, it was very clear that there was something going on, and that my spelling and my writing, in fact, was also terrible, and the speed with which I could read texts was slow. It was still obvious that I had an intelligence that didn't match, I suppose, my ability to express myself adequately in the school setting. So even though I had trouble with all of that stuff, the spelling and the writing and so on, no one really, well, I had one teacher that discouraged me, but most of my teachers were pretty good. And when I was in year 11, dyslexia wasn't a big thing. People didn't really diagnose it. There was no remedial kind of learning for kids with dyslexia. There was more of a sense that you just were unintelligent, not that you had a learning disability. But I did have a really great teacher in year 11 who recognized and named what was going on with me as dyslexia, and she gave me alternative ways to do exams, for instance, or essays, oral. She would give me oral assignments, and my parents were just very encouraging. They didn't care what the words looked like on paper. They just loved that I, you know, would write little poems and cards and things like that. So I got a lot of encouragement from home, and I wasn't discouraged at school, but I was also not encouraged. I wasn't a shining light, put it that way, in the English class.
And what was the first inkling you had of the Dictionary of Lost Words? What was the journey to that? I mean, particularly going through your first book, One Italian Summer, which is obviously quite a different novel or book to the Dictionary of Lost Words.
So it actually does start with One Italian Summer, though. I left work as an academic, kind of burnt out, and my family and I took a trip to Italy. And when I say a trip, we packed everything up, took the kids out of school, and travelled around Italy for about 5 months as willing workers on organic farms. And while we were over there, I had no intention of writing about it. But while we were there, towards the end of the trip, actually, I thought, actually, you know, this experience has been amazing. And I couldn't find anything about woofing, not in book form, before we left. And I was desperate to read something about traveling with your kids for an extended period of time and trying to work and all of that sort of thing, and couldn't. And I thought, well, there's, you know, maybe there is a book there. And although I hadn't really written anything since I was 15, I had wanted to. And I think a lot of people, as you get older, realize that some of those creative pursuits that you had as a young person that you've left behind for education and for a job and for a career, I think when you get to your 30s, 40s, 50s, I think this little knocking starts to happen where that creative urge wants to find expression again. And that had been happening for me and was probably one of the reasons I felt burnt out at work, because my work was no longer satisfying me enough to keep that creative urge silent. And so when we went to Italy and we had this incredible experience and I had time to reflect on what I wanted my life to be and what I wanted to do when we came back to Australia, one of those things, well, the only thing really for me, was writing. And so I thought about writing that memoir. And in writing the memoir, I very consciously thought, this is an apprenticeship for writing fiction. Because I'd been an academic for such a long time, I could write, but I wrote in a style that wasn't at all digestible to, you know, to the average person. And so writing creative nonfiction in terms of a memoir, for me, was a stepping stone towards writing fiction, which is what I really wanted to do. And then when I finished One Italian Summer, and it did quite well, you know, it was picked up off the slush pile. I didn't have an agent, and Affirm Press published it. And the process of editing and publishing was just so wonderful. And I learned so much about writing as well through that process. And I felt finally that I had what I needed to embark on fiction. And in fact, my first idea for a story was not the Dictionary of Lost Words. It was something else. It was something much more local. It was Australian. It was, in the way I thought of it, manageable. But I read Simon Winchester's The Surgeon of Crowthorne, which is all about the relationship between James Murray, who is the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, and one of the more prolific volunteers who would send in words and examples of how they'd been used in books. William Chester Minor was his name, and he was quite an interesting character because he was an inmate at Broadmoor Asylum for having killed a man. And that was an asylum for the criminally insane. And so it was a very interesting non-fiction book. And it told me a little bit about how the dictionary was developed. And when I got to the end of it, although the story was fascinating, the thing that stayed with me for months was the idea that the dictionary was a very male endeavour. Because, first of all, it was all the editors were male, all of the assistants who helped put the words together, all the lexicographers were male. There were a few females in there, daughters and wives particularly of editors, but they had no decision-making power. But the most important thing that I realised was the dictionary was developed based on how words were used in text, not how they were used in verbal language. So a word had to have been written down in order to make it into the dictionary. And it usually had to have been written down many times. Now, the dictionary, the Oxford English Dictionary, the whole project started in the 1850s and it finished in 1928.
Wow.
And I was thinking, yeah, who wrote the books before 1928? And the majority of the books were authored by men. And it made me realize that the dictionary is a gendered text, no matter how you look at it, no matter how much they tried to be objective, there is no way of getting around the fact that the data that they were relying on, and Greg, I used to be a social scientist, so this is the way I was thinking of it. I was thinking of it in a way from a research point of view. The data that they were relying on was biased towards the experiences and interests and emotions of men. It had to be, because 90% of the books that they used were written by men, and that's where the story started.
So how did your research proceed? Were you able to go to England, and where most of the novel is set?
Yes, I was so fortunate, and I feel, you know, right now I'm in lockdown. I don't know if you're in semi-lockdown, but half the country is in lockdown right now, you know, nearly 18 months after we heard of coronavirus. And there is no possibility of me travelling to the UK to do research. And so I feel incredibly fortunate when I think about, and when I say to you, I got to go to Oxford twice on research trips. I was given access to the archives of Oxford University Press and of the dictionary in particular. And when I say I was given access to the archives, I was given access to everything from the hundreds of boxes full of slips which have the words and their meanings, or the words and the sentences that they'd been used in, written on them, which people had sent in from all around the UK and from all around the world, in fact. So thousands and thousands of people would send in words and examples of how they'd been used in books. And I had access to those original slips of paper. Wow. I had access to all of the letters between the editors and assistants and various other people. I had access to photographs and news clippings. I had access to the proofs of the dictionary. And this is really interesting, because I could look at the final printed edition, first edition, and the proof pages that were possibly going to be printed. And I can look at how the editors had crossed out words. And when I did that, I found words that almost got in, but at the last minute were crossed out. And some of those words were women's words. When I say women's words, they were words that had been coined, perhaps, by a woman writer. And so there weren't many examples of use. And the word I'm thinking of here is the word literately. And the word literately, which sounds pretty ordinary to our ears, and now it is in the dictionary. It was only put back into the dictionary in the 1990s, I think. But it was going to be in the dictionary back around 1900. But at the last minute, it was crossed out. And that was coined in a book by Mrs. Griffith. So she has no first name. She's a Mrs. Griffith. And before it got crossed out, it had five lines, including the sentence it was used in and so on. And I can't remember the sentence exactly, but you would understand it. It's something like something was literately written. It means it was well written. On the same page was a word, the word literata, and this was coined by Coleridge, and there was no other use of it in any other book. Huh. It gets five lines and it stayed in. And literata is defined as a literary lady. Huh. And the reason I found this interesting is because surely a literary lady is no different to a literary man and can just fall under the definition of literati, which means a literary person. And so, you know, these are just some of the things that I was able to see by going into the archives. because I could handle those original pieces of paper. And not only that, I got to walk around the streets of Oxford. I got to go into the pubs that my characters go into. I got to go into the theatre, new theatre that my characters frequent. Of course, I got to visit the Bodleian Library, and I found out that you cannot borrow books from the Bodleian Library. And that is probably the most important thing that I learned from this research trip, because throughout my novel, one of my first early drafts of my novel, I had people borrowing books from the Bodleian left, right and centre. And had I not gone to Oxford, I may not have realised that, and my book would have been criticised from quite rightly, left, right and centre.
The novel's mainly written in first person from Esme's point of view. I wonder what led you to make that decision to use that point of view.
Two things. One was very practical. The book that I'd just written was a memoir written from in first person. And so it was a point of view that I was used to writing. But the main reason, I would have written it differently if not for this reason. The main reason was that a first person point of view, I think, can bring the reader closer to the internal and emotional world of the protagonist. And in this book, what I did with Esme is I wanted to put a young woman, a girl, in fact, I wanted to put her in the midst of the Oxford English Dictionary, the development of the dictionary. And I wanted to see what influence the dictionary would have on her as she grows into a woman, but also what kind of influence she could have on the dictionary or on language as she grew into a woman. That was, in essence, what my book was about. And writing it in first person, I suppose, gives me and the reader access to what can sometimes be very nuanced experiences when you're talking about, you know, I'm talking about, you know, how what is the emotional experience of a word, largely, you know, all the way through my novel, I am examining how words affect Esme on an emotional and an intellectual and a social level, I suppose. And I didn't want to commentate that. I wanted it to be a lived experience, and so that's why I used first person.
And was it an easy job, or did you find it difficult to insert your character into these, you know, in inverted commas, real people?
It was difficult sometimes, and in other ways, I found it quite comforting to have a scaffold, I suppose. Again, when I wrote One Italian Summer, the scaffold was my travel itinerary in a way. I followed my itinerary and relived that journey from an emotional point of view when I wrote it. In this book, The Dictionary of Lost Words, the itinerary or the scaffold was the historical context of the development of the Oxford English Dictionary. And something that was very, very important to me for this book was to stay true to the historical facts as we know them. Certain words were published at certain times in certain years. I don't change any of that. I wanted everything we knew about this time in history, you know, World War I events, suffrage events, dictionary events. I didn't want to change any of that known history. What I wanted to do was fill in the gaps in that history. And there are many, as there are in all histories. And in a way, I was writing between the lines of the Oxford English Dictionary. I feel like Esme's story is the story that is in the shadows, in the white space, if you like, of the dictionary. And Lizzie's story, so Lizzie is the maid who is really Esme's greatest confidant and friend and a surrogate mother in many ways. Now, this isn't Lizzie's story, and in my mind, Lizzie's story lies between the lines of the Dictionary of Lost Words, in a way. Lizzie, as a working class woman, her story is kind of subtly hinted at rather than told, whereas Esme's story is told in this book, and she's a middle class woman. I just wanted to fill in the gaps of history, really, without changing the history.
The novel's written mostly in the past tense, which I must admit is refreshing against the present kind of blinding vogue of present tense set novels. What was your planning around that?
Oh, I reckon if you ask most writers this question, they'll say they juggled or, you know, toggled between past and present tense for quite some time before they settled. And I think I did that. I found, you know, my first draft, you know, I'd have a few paragraphs that were present tense, then a past tense paragraph, then a present tense paragraph, and so on. But when it came down to it, I did want it to be past tense, partly because it is historical. I also wanted, I didn't want the, I was writing a character from the age of four up until adulthood. If it was present tense, I would have really had to change the language, the voice of Esme as a four-year-old. As a four-year-old, even though I have written in the past tense in a younger voice, I couldn't have written her as a four-year-old in the present tense. It just wouldn't work. And it worked much better for me, I think, to have that sort of past tense voice, because then there could be a certain amount of leeway, if you like, in the sound of the voice. She didn't have to sound like a four-year-old. She just had to sound younger, if you like. So the way I always thought of it is that Esme was narrating this story from a few years in the future, but not from, you know, old age and looking back on her past. She was always just ahead of the time that is being written about.
Right. I mean, writing anything, you know, as our discussions have alluded to today, is, I mean, writing anything is incredibly ephemeral, and writing a dictionary must be like 1,000 times harder, really. Like all these puffs of air that we bandy around, you know, they become fixed and become material in a way. I just wondered, did you get a sense while you were researching and writing even of the kind of enormity and the difficulty of that task?
I really did, Greg, and that's why the other thing that was important to me in this book, and it would have been really easy, I think, to write a book where all of the men involved in writing the dictionary were, you know, were in some way motivated to leave women out of it in some way, but that's not the case, and it's certainly not the sense I got from all of the research that I did. The sense I got from the research that I did was that this task was enormous, and I liken it to mapping the human genome. It was, when they first started collating the words, they thought it might take 10 years, and in the end it took 70. And it really took up all of James Murray's life. And he died before the dictionary was completed. It wasn't completed for another 13 years after his death, and he had worked on it for decades. And his daughters, two of his daughters, worked on it their entire lives, just about, and so did other people. I have no doubt that they also tried to do the very best by the language that they could. James Murray always understood that English was a dynamic language. It was never set in stone. And in fact, he fought for newspaper quotations to be used as evidence of the meaning of a word. And when I say fought, he was constantly battling against the men who held the purse strings, and they were the delegates of Oxford University Press. And James Murray was actually an outsider to this group of men who were all Oxford, Cambridge educated. James Murray was a school teacher from Scotland, and he didn't have a degree from Oxford or Cambridge. In fact, I don't think he had a degree at all when he first started the project. He was given an honorary degree from Oxford much later, but he had to really earn his place as editor. And he was the best man for the job at the time, and I believe that. And I believe that he did the best he could to make it as objective as possible. And he had a scientific method, he called it a scientific method, in terms of how to include or exclude words. But even he neglected to use that method for some words. And I won't say the word, but pretty much every word that a child looks up when they first get a dictionary, I'm thinking of 8 to 12-year-old kids when they get a dictionary, think of the words you looked up, the first words you looked up. It was all the swear words. And they are the words that these Victorian men had trouble with. And they had trouble with them on so many levels because they were under the false impression that if they left a word out of the dictionary, it might fall out of use. And so there were some words they didn't want in the dictionary because they didn't want to encourage vulgar language. And there were other words they left out simply because they weren't written down. And if they weren't written down, it was likely because they were used by the working classes or by women, and this is where my idea first came from, by women in contexts that men who wrote books were never in, like the birthing room or the laundry or the scullery. Mm. Contexts that working class men were in, but the men who wrote books weren't in. And so a lot of slang doesn't make it into the Oxford English Dictionary because it's not considered proper. But in fact, they are proper words if they're used by people and understood by others. But James Murray understood that one of the most up-to-date sources of the meaning of a word was the newspapers. And he had to fight for newspaper quotations to be used in the dictionary, and he won that fight. And I think a similar fight today would be, you know, looking to social media and some of the language that would be used in social media and making a decision about, you know, are the words that we use in social media real words or not? That's the equivalent.
Yeah, I guess, though, they were limited to written text in a way because, you know, recordings would have been fairly new at that stage. You know, they were literally trying to pin down something that was moving very rapidly. So written text was really the only source of information they had that was fixed.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And so in some ways they were hamstrung because unless they went out and recorded in writing words that were being used in various contexts, they had to rely on published text, books, scientific journals, newspapers. Now, newspapers were interesting because newspapers do coin words all the time and they don't always stick to the tongue, if you like. So I'm thinking of some of the words I came across on slips that had been sent in for consideration are words around the suffrage movement. So the word suffragette was coined in 1906 by newspaper men, and it was actually used as a derogatory term for the women who were starting to become militant in their protests and their call for the vote. And it was used to diminish them. They weren't real suffragists. They were kind of mini versions, if you like, or less important than the real suffragists who were, you know, who were making eloquent speeches in at marches and so on. So it was originally used as an insult, and there were other words that sprung up around it. And the word suffragette, it's a wonderful word because, in fact, it was coined by newspaper men as an insult, but then it was taken on by the suffrage movement, by the Emmeline Pankhurst and the women of the WSPU, who decided to call their journal The Suffragette. And all of a sudden, they changed the meaning of the word from a negative insult to a positive banner under which a lot of women then could rally. And in fact, we still use it today as an umbrella term for the suffrage movement, which isn't quite correct, but that's how pervasive that word has become. But getting back to the original coining, other words that were coined at the time were suffragetting, which was like a verb, you know, it's the action of going out and being a militant suffragist. Suffragettes, which is one of my favourites, which were men who supported the suffragettes. So all these words were also written up in newspapers more than once and might have made it into the dictionary, but they didn't really last. And so there's history is strewn with words that haven't stuck to the tongue, and that's why they often don't get into dictionaries. But and sometimes that's you know, a good thing, because otherwise the dictionary will be cluttered up with a whole lot of words that, you know, had a two-week life. Yeah, that's right. But and other times, though, words that have been around a very long time never made it in at all. And when I say a very long time, I'm talking hundreds and hundreds of years, and in text, and they still didn't make it in because some people were offended by them.
Yeah, I wonder if Murray did have a sense, though, that this was a step forward to a specific end, you know, rather than the end of defining words.
Yes, he did. And we know this because after he published the letter A and B, and I have that dictionary next to me right here, a first edition of volume one, A and B, after he published that.
It's a very good place to start.
Yes, it is a good place to start. And it took them about 10 years to collect the words just for those two letters, by the way. But after he finished, he realised that there were so many words missing. Because he regretted some decisions. So, for instance, Africa isn't in that dictionary, but America is, or African isn't, American is. And that's because early on in the collection of the words, he didn't want pronouns. But as they moved through, they realised actually you can't describe a whole lot of things related to a country unless you have that pronoun in there. And so American gets in, but Africa doesn't. And so he really regretted that and immediately started collecting words for a supplement. Now, this first supplement wasn't published until 1933. And so, you know, a lot of words were collected. As soon as they published a volume of words, they were already collecting new words for the supplement that would come out later on. So he was very aware that this would be a first edition and that it would be added to year on year on year. And now because we have digital technology, that is exactly what they do. They add words every few months to the Oxford English Dictionary. And they're, in fact, currently they're trying to collate the third edition of the Oxford English Dictionary. They're not sure if it will ever be published in text, as in hard copy, because it will be so enormous. Because one of the things that they never do is get rid of a word from the Oxford English Dictionary, not from the complete volume.
Right.
They might from their concise dictionaries and so on, because they always have to juggle, you know, what are the most common words in use for a concise volume. But for the large dictionary, for the complete dictionary, they never take a word out.
I'm always surprised at the squeamishness around some words to describe bits of female anatomy, whereas every bit of a male's anatomy seems to be up for grabs, literally.
Yeah, literally.
I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about the process of excluding, you know, words and the decisions around those.
Yeah, I have so many thoughts, Greg, and I think some of them have probably most likely seeped into the Dictionary of Lost Words. There are a few characters in the book who are not people, they are words. One of them is Bondmaid, and Bondmaid is, it's not a spoiler to say, it is really the catalyst that gets this book going. Bondmaid was in real life lost from that first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary and from that first volume, A and B. It should have been in there, but it wasn't. It went missing somewhere along the line. And in my story, Esme is the one who stole it when she was four. And that's where the story gets going. And the reason I have her steal it is because we actually don't know what happened to the word bondmaid. We don't know how it was lost. But it's one word that should have been in there. So James Murray wanted it in there and it just never made it.
How did you discover that?
Oh, look, I discovered that by reading other people's writing. So Simon Winchester's book talks about it. Not the book I told you about, but there's another book called The Meaning of Everything. It's a very pithy summary of, you know, pithy story of the development of the Oxford English Dictionary. And he talks about it. Peter Gilliver, who is a current lexicographer at the Oxford English Dictionary, has written a history of the dictionary. A very weighty tome, but it was my Bible while I was reading this book because it gives me the history. And it talks about the word bondmaid. And I had the enormous pleasure and privilege of being able to talk to him face to face in Oxford and get a whole lot of other little anecdotes that aren't in his history either, but I could use them to flesh out some of the characters in my book. So most of the lexicographers in my book are real people, but of course there's not as much written about them as there is about the editors. But Peter Gilliver had, you know, lovely little morsels of information about who they were as people, and I could use that to help flesh out their characters, which was lovely. So in terms of the words that have basically a character arc in my book, bondmaid is one of them. The other, and language warning, is cunt. And the reason I include that word is because that is the word I'm talking about when I say some words were left out that should have been put in according to the scientific criteria that James Murray himself developed. It is a word that has been around for centuries. Famously, you know, it's in Chaucer. I think it's in Shakespeare. I think it's in so much of English literature.
Well, it's in and Sex and the City, so.
Well, of course. And if only James Murray knew about that, all the words that would have been included. And it's also got a very interesting history. In fact, the first time the word was ever written down, as far as we know, and of course, you know, this social archaeologists can always find things out later. But as far as we know, the first time it was written down was on a street sign because it was actually the name of a street. And I'll say the name. And before I say it, though, I'll just let you know it was a street in London.
In London. Yeah.
In London. And it was at a time when street names were pretty much named, streets were named after their economic activity. Okay. So this street was called Grope Cunt Lane, which gives you a hint to what went on in the street. But it was written on the street sign for all to see.
It was near St. Paul's, wasn't it?
Yes. And it's now called Magpie Lane. Yeah. So at some stage, you know, the censors went through and changed the names of lots of streets. But also in Chaucer's time, it was used as a euphemism, not as an insult, if that makes sense. And so the word itself has changed over the decades. And it just so happens that when James Murray and his team were collating words for the English dictionary, that word had morphed into an insult. And I find it really fascinating that that parts of women's anatomy are used to insult not women usually, but to insult men. You know, that in itself is interesting, and you could unpack it, but they have appropriated a part of a woman's anatomy as the vilest form of insult for usually a man these days, for anybody, but back in the day often for a man. And there are other words as well that apply only to women, and there's no equivalent for men. So, for instance, words such as a scold is applied to women, and a scold is a woman who shrieks a lot or, you know, gets upset and so on. And so you've heard of a scold's bridle was actually a device that was put on women, a metal device, like a gag that was put in her mouth to stop her from speaking. Mm. And there are so many words that just don't have male equivalents. Mrs. is an example of a word that has no male equivalent. Mm. And I find this fascinating, actually, because when you have master and miss for children, for a child boy and a child girl, but when a boy reaches manhood, he's called Mr. A girl doesn't reach maturity until she's married. So no matter how old she is, mm. she remains Miss. Until she's married, and then she's Mrs. And I find even that, you know, there are so many interesting words that tell us something about the place of women in society, about their bodies. So that's the other interesting thing about the dictionary. When I was looking at the first edition of the dictionary, I looked up other words and that are to do with women's bodies. So one of them was I looked up clitoris, and clitoris isn't in the first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, even though it would have been in medical text at the time. Now, I could actually have that wrong, and if I've got it wrong, it's because I'm mixing it up with another word that I just couldn't understand the meaning of. So right. They were so nervous of the word, I suppose, or so anxious about the word that they couldn't describe it in plain English.
Yeah, look, I think that happened with a lot of words. I remember looking up fart, and I think the definition was an explosion between the legs. And, I walked away from the dictionary as confused. So it's books were... these words were words that people needed to look up. And so the dictionary was usurping its job, really, by not providing those definitions.
That's right. And in fact, that's what I have Esme do. So at different times of Esme's life, she turns to the dictionary and the scriptorium, which is where her father and James Murray are doing their work. And it's also where those slips of paper I've talked about are all around the walls, you know, stored in pigeonholes. This is where she finds out about the world. This is her world in many ways. This is where she's grown up. And she hasn't got a mother, and her father adores her, but his currency is words. So when she wants to know something, she goes to the pigeonholes and she looks up the word that she's heard, and she tries to understand what it means. And when she, for instance, gets her period, she tries to understand what's going on with her body, you know, everything from just the pain of it, the bleeding, the way she's being treated. And she can't find a single word that explains what's going on for her. She can't find any words that equate to her experience. And in a way, the dictionary lets her down. The English language lets her down. And that's one of the things I wanted to explore, I suppose, in the book, is if you put a woman in the context of the Oxford English Dictionary, does it satisfy her experience, her life experience? And the answer was no. Because the words were being written and defined by men. So how could it?
Mm. Just getting back to the construction of the novel, I just wonder, was it difficult or a risky decision to have those concluding sections bouncing the reader forward quite a bit in time? Because, you know, in a matter of a few pages, we go from 1915 to 28 to 1989. So it's quite a jump.
Yeah. You know, when I was conceiving of the novel, and I am a bit of a planner, so I did know where the novel was going. And initially I wanted the novel to go right through to 1928. But what I realized when I got to 1915, and I, you know, I don't know who'll be listening to this and how much of this is spoilers, but I, you know, I think I'll talk about it anyway. In 1915, James Murray dies, and a few months after he dies, the scriptorium is torn down. It's emptied of all its contents, of all its words, of all of Esme's life, essentially. And so Esme has grown up in this garden shed called the scriptorium, which is where all the words for the English dictionary were being bedded down. And when James Murray, the editor, dies, that shed was in his backyard, front yard, actually. And so they move everything and everyone to the old Ashmolean, where one of the other editors is set up, and everyone just starts working from there. But in a way, for me, that's where Esme's story ends. And other things happen in that year as well that are significant and that draw to a close a part of Esme's life. And for me, there was nowhere else to go. I couldn't write the next sort of 13 years of her life. I mean, no one would have wanted to read it. It just would have dragged on and on and on, because that's really where this story stops. And 1928 is significant in the story, but also in the history of the dictionary, because that's when the final volume was published. And it's also, it also sums up both the story I was trying to tell, because they had a celebration for the final publication of the dictionary in 1928, presided over by the Prime Minister of the day, and they invited 150 people who had been involved in the dictionary in big ways and small, and they had this lavish dinner at Goldsmiths Hall in London. And those 150 people were all men, every single one of them, even though there were women who had worked on the dictionary, including two of James Murray's daughters, the daughter of one of the other editors, and Edith Thompson, who is a character in my story. And she's based on a real person, but I have also fictionalized her to some extent. But I wanted to keep her in because she was a volunteer, not a paid worker. But she worked on every volume of the dictionary from A to Z, and she dedicated her life to this enterprise. And she and two of the other women were allowed to sit in the balcony of Goldsmiths Hall and watch the men eat. Mm. They weren't allowed to eat with them. They weren't allowed to celebrate with them, but they were allowed to watch. And, you know, I just thought that summed up so much of the times, of, I suppose, what I was exploring in terms of the place of women's lives in the dictionary. And I felt that that was a proper ending for the story of the dictionary. And I do then come forward to 1989, because that's when the second edition of the dictionary was published. And I thought it was important to show how much time it took really for there to be a second edition, but also to bring it back to who we are now, and to, I suppose, identify that, you know, while this is historical fiction and it's talking about an historical object, which is the first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, that object is actually ever evolving, and it evolves because we evolve. And bringing the story to a near future in terms of where we are now allowed me to, I suppose, draw that bow, draw that piece of string that exists between, you know, the women I was writing about at the turn of the 19th, 20th century and languages and words that are threatened now. And when I talk about language and words that have been threatened over the last 100 years, I suppose I'm talking specifically about the languages of First Nations people. And like women 100 years ago, their languages have, their words haven't been written down largely. And because they haven't been written down, they have very largely been lost. And there is a bit of a resurgence, thank goodness, of Indigenous languages in Australia and around the world. And this can really only happen in some places because some people did write words down. In Adelaide, where I live, the Kaurna language, and I really should right from the outset have acknowledged not only the Kaurna people who were the first people of the Adelaide Plains and who are still the custodians of that land, and the Paramank people where I live in the Adelaide Hills, who are the custodians of the land where I've written most of this book. Kaurna language has been preserved to some extent by because German missionaries took it upon themselves to write down a lot of the words that they were hearing, and they met with elders of the Adelaide Plains, and together those elders and these German missionaries wrote down many Kaurna words. And today Kaurna is being taught to children in Adelaide. And, you know, that wouldn't happen, and those words wouldn't have value for all of us, not just Kaurna people. But words are a form of reconciliation. When we can speak the words of another people, that is an act of reconciliation. I wanted to acknowledge that words are important, and it's important to actually go out and seek the words of people who may not have the inclination or any other reason to write them down. They can't be ignored, because if you take words away from a people, you're taking away their history, you're taking away their connection to their ancestors, to people, to place, but mostly, and very importantly, not most importantly, but very importantly, you're taking away their ability to share their culture and history with you, because they can no longer tell you what it is in their own words.
Well, a different language definitely right. Carves up the world in a different way, doesn't it?
It really does. And you only have to look at yourself in a foreign language, in a foreign land, you know, when you're traveling, and you're trying to express yourself in someone else's language, and you just don't have the words. And just realize how that makes you feel, how impotent it makes you feel when you can't actually express your needs or communicate your joy or whatever it might be, or your fears, because you can't speak the language of the place that you're in. For that to be your experience in the place where you live would be extraordinarily difficult.
Just to finish up today, given that the novel's a very female story, I'm just wondering, when you're writing, if you're conscious of the gender of your readers?
No, not at all. I'm not an idiot. So once I'd written this book, I realized it would probably be enjoyed by women like me. You know, I wrote a book that I was interested in reading, and so I can only assume from that other people like me would be interested in reading it. I've been delighted by the number of emails I've had from men, particularly older men, and I think it might just be they've got more time on their hands to write emails to strangers, but telling me how much they enjoyed the book, and sometimes giving me advice on grammar, which I have to say a lot of writers don't appreciate, but I do. And I've really been thrilled by the reception that it's got from older people, women, and young women as well. I've had a number of teenage girls contact me to tell me what the book means to them, and that's extremely satisfying, because I wish I'd read a book like this when I was young. I would have looked at not just the dictionary, but encyclopedias and every text that I was told was objective and telling me facts and telling me the way of the world, I would have looked at them very differently. I would have asked, who's written this? Whose history is this? And mostly I would have asked, what is missing? Because it's not that those books are wrong, it's just that they're partial. And sometimes we don't know that as young people. And I would have been very grateful to have somehow realised through fiction, perhaps, that I can question the veracity of those texts that everyone is telling me are objective and unquestionable. They're not.
Well, that's a great point for us to end on today, I think. Thank you very much for your time. I've really enjoyed the discussion.
Oh, thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
This episode features just one of over 70 speakers in our HNSA conference program. Our guest of honour is Geraldine Brooks. Other speakers include Stephen Carroll, Rosalie Hamm, and Kate Nunn, to name just a few. There'll also be special guest appearances from international best-selling authors Kate Quinn, Ben Kane, and Elizabeth Chadwick. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past.